some people in this country sort of dismiss, oh, the UN Charter is international law, and therefore that's very remote.
And again,
reminding us that, you know, the world is not remote, that as humans we do need to be able to make and honor agreements with each other. That's crucial. But even so, within the United States Constitution, there is one clause. It's actually considered the most important clause in the Constitution. It's called the Supremacy Clause. It's Article 6, Section 2.
Uh-huh.
And it's the clause that makes the United States out of the several states. It gives supremacy, priority, to the laws of the United States over the laws of any individual state.
I see.
So it's what actually created the nation, this clause. So it's considered, you know, the central clause. Anytime there's a debate about states' rights or the power of the EPA or anything like that, or the president, I mean, this is what that all of the Congress and president's power hinges on a legal sense. That clause has two parts to it. One is this giving supremacy to the federal government, and the other says very clearly that all treaties shall be considered the supreme law of the land and shall be enforced by every judge in every state. And it also goes on to say not any other laws or matters notwithstanding.
What does that last part mean, any matters notwithstanding?
Well, we could sort of veer off into an area about how important this was for the writers of the Constitution. I'll just quickly go there, because for them, to go back to that time, what they were really reacting against was royal power.
Mm-hmm.
And they had lived under kings, the whole world was living under kings, this sense of arbitrary power, and there had been countless cases of wars being fought because a king was in love with someone in another country. And, you know, and what this meant was that people were dying and taxes were being raised, people's lives were being diminished, all because of this arbitrary royal power. So this is what they were guarding against, the what we would today call executive war powers. And what they are saying in that phrase, any other issues notwithstanding, they are trying to be very, very clear that only the elected bodies, Congress and the Senate, will have the power to make treaties. And once these treaties are made, the president will, and any other entity, political entity, the justice system or whatever, will not have the power to abrogate the treaties, to deny or defy them. They're basically trying to set in stone, in right in front of our eyes, that the rule of law,
mm-hmm.
and that, as opposed to, you know, arbitrary personal desires of the powerful. So
in order for them to not abide by the treaties, they would have to disengage from them, somehow remove the country from the treaties.
Exactly.
Instead of ignoring the fact that they exist.
Exactly. And what we have now is a situation where the law and the Constitution are very, very clear. There's just no question about that. And, of course, every elected official from the president on down to the local judges all swear to uphold the Constitution. So it's this tremendous contradiction where we have this treaty that was overwhelmingly endorsed. And, again, it's around the world. It's not, you know, it's not just a small thing. It's the biggest agreement or law that humans have ever made with each other, and it's in force all the time. And the United States is routinely and deliberately ignoring it, even though this means also deliberately ignoring the Constitution. And, you know, we scratch our heads and say, how can this be? And then there's a useful analogy for me is to remind ourselves that we've been in this place before, this country has. And one of the clearest cases was during the whole time of lynching that happened for generations in this country. And, of course, lynching is always illegal. It is, by definition, extrajudicial murder, outside the law murder. And yet, it went on, and it was supported by all of the sort of powerful elements of society, whether it was the police or the courts or the merchants or whoever you want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for generations. And it took a long movement by thousands and thousands of types of this racism, of this murder, to an end in this country. And the laws were always the same. The law, it was always illegal to lynch.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, over time, we ended up changing our morality to the point where we started enforcing the laws as they were written. And you know, there's a big asterisk here. I'm not at all claiming, even for, you know, in a fraction, that racism has ended or anything like that, because that's not the case. It's shifted. But I will say that conditions, if you put yourself in a small town, say in Georgia or Mississippi, and you say you're an African-American parent and you're holding your child in your arms in the early 1900s, you look out and say, what hope would there ever be that the lynching times are going to end? Because all the forces of society around you tend to support that, support the whole system of white supremacy. And yet, within the lifetime of that child, very significant changes have happened. If you go, I mean, I've had friends down in a small town in Georgia and who have been activists down there, and they'll say very clearly that things are very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a kind of a hope that I bring to this quest of ending war, is that within our lifetimes, I believe that we can end what can only be called sort of American supremacy. It has a word. It's called American exceptionalism, which is basically routinely ignoring our laws. The idea that the United States, what George Bush said publicly, I don't need permission to defend the country, the nation. In fact, he does need permission under our laws. And it's very similar to the same kind of justification that was used for lynching. And so I don't know if I'm being clear, but that's an analogy that I'm trying to tease out,
mm-hmm.
and to both to help recognize, because what we're engaged in is international lynching right now. That's what we're doing. Every drone strike, every Afghani or Pakistani or Somali or Yemeni that's killed is illegal. It's murder on our part. There's no question about that. There's just no question about that. And
when the laws against lynching began to be enforced, what do you know what that looked like at that time? How it changed from a system of blatantly ignoring these laws to where they became enforced more and more?
Yeah, that was it's a long process. It is a whole history. I mean, courses are taught on this. Some very strong crusaders. Ida Tarbell comes to mind. She's considered one of the leaders of the movement. That would tirelessly go around to the legislatures, to groups, to church groups, and just not only remind people, but force people to recognize that the lynching is an evil that should not happen. It's immoral and illegal. And so it was a long process, and there were many artists involved. There's one of the most significant things. There were dozens and dozens of plays written about the strange fruit hanging from the southern trees. Mm. And that sort of started bringing the humanity of the people, started opening up that door that these are real human beings. There was another, the whole civil rights movement was crucial, along with Brown versus the Board of Education, 1954, recognizing that the country was no longer going to be legal for had to have separate but equal institutions, that in a sense acknowledging that all Americans are equal, bringing that promise a little bit closer to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another element, which I think it has a parallel too, which is at the time during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union was using the blatant examples of American racism as a hammer in international forums to debase the United States, especially in Africa. And they were, being very critical of the United States. And so there was, among the elite, the power elites even, there was this sense of, well, maybe, we need to address this issue a little more publicly. And that was an element of the shift among the politicians to start responding to these cries, to these pleas, to these demands to end the most blatant forms of racism in the country. And of course all what's the word, germinated or came to fruition in the 60s with the strong civil rights. But it's important to recognize that the movement itself has been going on for decades before that.
Go ahead. You're familiar how there's 38 of us going on trial for protesting the unmanned hunter-killer Reaper drones out at the Hancock Air Force Base, and when we went into the courtroom to make our motions to the judge, we did make a motion in limine to allow the testimony of an expert witness on international law. And the reasoning that we gave was Article 6, Section 2, Supremacy Clause, that all these treaties that we sign are supreme law of the land to be followed in every court. And the judge denied us that motion. And maybe you could explain to the listeners why a judge would think that they should deny that and why you believe that they should uphold that.
Yeah, that's a very common tradition. And thank you all for taking that stand. That's exactly the kind of action that we need by citizens to bring an end to war. There's a long-standing tradition in the United States in the judicial branch. It's called, in quotes, the political question. And it's started in 1803 with Marbury versus Madison. But the most sort of accessible case that is applicable today is Baker versus Carr in the early 1960s, wherein the Supreme Court has basically set out areas on which what they call are justiciable, in other words, upon which their branch of government will rule. And they have set out guidelines to determine what issues come under the judiciary and which issues are resolved or remain within the other branches of government, basically the Congress and the executive. And Justice Brennan, I'm looking through my notes right here for a minute. Justice Brennan actually wrote this Baker versus Carr. It was a very monumental, wrenching decision. It took months. And it wasn't about international law at all. It was simply about apportionment in the state legislature. But the court used it as a case to lay out very clearly, what issues would be considered justiciable and which issues would not.
Could you define apportionment and justiciable?
They didn't. It was very narrow finding. For me, the interest in the case was not so much about what happened with the apportionment, and I am not that familiar with that part of it. But what did come up was Brennan laid out six factors that will determine what is justiciable and which is not. And, of course, this then applies to all the other lower courts.
And justiciable just means whether or not the judges have the ability to rule on it.
Exactly, yep.
And what is the, I forgot the other term that you used, apportionment. What is apportionment?
Oh, that's a when you're determining the boundaries of a representative's district. Every 10 years, you're required, under the Constitution, you determine, the state legislature determines where each district, well, the boundaries of it. In other words, what citizens are included in which district and which go to the next district.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been a very controversial part because it so much depends on it. Like, I mean, this is a totally side issue, but, you know, when the Democrats are in power, they try to set things up so that more Democrats are likely to be elected, and the same with the Republicans. There's big issues like that in Texas recently. But New York is, the word gerrymandering came from that. So that's, it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. It's just another part of our democratic process.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that is relevant to your question about why the judge won't let you even, in effect, read the Constitution in their courtroom, you know, which is astonishing when it applies to international law. Brennan just, you know, outlined these six factors, and the first one that he outlined was, this is legal wording, it's not my words, but this is what the case said. They will not rule on a case when there is, quote, textually demonstrable constitutional commitment of the issue to a coordinate political department. An example that he gives is foreign affairs and executive war powers. So basically what the Supreme Court said in this case in the 1960s is that the legal system, the judiciary, is not going to get involved in any way in foreign affairs or executive war powers. And what's so interesting, this is an absolutely direct contradiction to the Constitution. So this is the situation we find ourselves in today as peace activists trying to bring the United States to honor its word,
mm-hmm.
not only its word, but also morality, and honor the reality that all people are essentially equal, and that the life of an Iraqi or a Pakistani is equal to an American. And that's what we're working for, toward. And we're faced with this very blatant contradiction. And the judges will not even respond to it. And it's because they feel justified in this because of this long-standing tradition, what's called the political question, that they are not going to get involved in foreign affairs. And in a sense, they're just reading out that phrase from the one that requires them to treat all treaties as the supreme law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
They're just reading it out. And again, to me, this is the analogy, again, can be with the blatant racism. You know, I think it was the 13th Amendment that said there should be no discrimination based on race. And yet, 30 years later, in Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court basically ignored that and said, separate. It's okay to have segregation. And so I feel, I mean, that was a completely blatant contradiction in the full light of day before the world. And I feel that's what we're faced with now. And we need to keep putting the pressure on, keep reminding the judges that this is a contradiction and that they are required under the Constitution to uphold the treaty, the UN Charter.
So the decision that was made based on the 1960 case, was that reinforced with the previous findings from the Marbury versus Madison case?
Yes. Yep. It was basically, you could say, clarifying it, or
And then, how do cases that are like this that people feel are unconstitutional? How are laws that are said to be unconstitutional then overturned?
It's a very good question. Of course, it's the heart of what we're talking about. How do we get to the point where the United States honors its words and stops starting wars? This is not a law. This tradition, that's why I keep calling it tradition. Nowhere in the Constitution or any in Congress was there ever a law to this effect. This is simply a judicial tradition, and and that's why I'm using this analogy of racism or lynching, that was always illegal. And under the 13th Amendment, it's always been illegal to discriminate on the basis of race. But there was a tradition, you know, based on our society's inherent racism for so long, that, well, we're not going to apply this law. We're just going to sort of ignore that. Even though the Constitution is very clear, we're just going to, you know, ignore it. And that's the situation we're in today. And instead of the analogy I'm making, instead of based on white supremacy, which is what the racism was based on all of those years and generations, it's now based on sort of American exceptionalism, that, well, even if we sign these laws and even if they apply to the rest of the world, they don't really apply to us. And therefore, we're not going to really prosecute anyone for breaking these laws.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's really going on here. So the movement, when I, you know, I'm talking a lot about international law, but this isn't as much a legal question as it is a moral question and an evolution of society question. The way that racism, it wasn't that someone just passed a law that ended lynching. In fact, there never was a law passed to end lynching. It was simply that through activists and concerned people and churches and, you know, education, and again, through the sort of recognizing of common humanity, we just came to see that lynching is an evil thing. It should be stopped.
No.
And we started applying the laws that were already in place.
When you say that about the judges having a tradition of not ruling on matters that have the political question within them, was there also a tradition within the lynching where judges were basing their decisions on other previous cases where lynching went unprosecuted, or you know, people were not these things were not considered crimes? Did they ever base that on case law, or was it blatantly ignored?
The answer is I'm not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a lot about that history and studied it, and there was a wide range of responses by judges. Some of them actually were very fierce in upholding the law, and sometimes they were alone against every other part of society, standing up. There's some extraordinary cases where judges tried to apply the law, and, you know, the police and the prosecutors and the townspeople of the town simply chased the judge out of town. So, but by and large, the way it actually worked was everyone just looked the other way. There were very few prosecutions. And so it almost never came to a court. And if it did, often the judges would, you know, they have a lot of power in the courtroom. And they could either dismiss the case or make, you know, discredit evidence, or just basically, it's important. I think it's part of the analogy that I'm trying to make is to remember the mindset at the time that it was for the white power structure, it was very important to sort of maintain that power. And so even if, you know, the wrong person was lynched, or if, you know, even if the evidence was clear that these people had done it, there was still a feeling like, well, it's kind of necessary. Anyways, we need to sort of show people, give people a lesson. And that, to me, that's exactly what's happening here today with the drones. It's like, well, maybe we got the wrong person, but it's still important to maintain our power and their fear. And, yeah, it's too bad if we killed somebody else along the way, but it's still kind of necessary to defend our security and our power and just sort of our supremacy. So that is sort of the heart of this analogy, that if you ever wondered what you would have done if you lived in a small town in Georgia during the lynching times, now is your chance to find out. Because we're lynching. We're committing international lynching.
Uh-huh.
Every day. And you and the 38 people that stood up in Syracuse are taking a strong stand, and you're doing what needs to be done. So thank you again.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left, and I was wondering if you can address again with the tradition of judges not hearing international law, why it's justified for them to listen to it. And I know that you have a variety of reasons, and one of them being what you mentioned in the beginning of the interview about how bipartisan the agreement was to sign into the UN Charter. But if you could speak about that and maybe any other reasons that the judge should be compelled to hear international law in the courtroom?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes, for one, is like you just mentioned, that the legislative branch has spoken very clearly through the Senate and committed the United States to this very important treaty. Another reason for the judges to get involved and to, in a sense, follow their oath to uphold the Constitution is that most treaties are very complex and huge, weighty documents. The law of the sea would probably weigh as much as we do. And by far, most of these treaties all have within them a means of compliance or an enforcement mechanism built into them. And they're actually designed to be followed by experts, by legal experts or, you know, bankers or whatever the treaty is dealing with. The UN Charter is different, and it's written in very simple language. It begins, "In order to end the scourge of war," and that's its purpose. And it's a purpose that affects every person on the planet. And so the UN Charter does not have an enforcement mechanism built into it for powerful nations. And so we come to the judges of the land and say, this, the most important agreement that we have, does not have an enforcement agreement within it. And therefore, it's up to us to build such a mechanism, a way of enforcing it. And I think it's important to recognize that our ancestors, the people that gave us this document, they knew this, that it would take a lot to actually bring this, to make it a reality, practical, routine reality, to end war. And that's been a long dream. But they gave us the start, which is this agreement. And now it's up to us to build a way of honoring it and of figuring out what to do when a nation, especially a strong nation, does not honor it. And so we're coming to the judges and saying, this treaty, the indications are that the enforcement mechanism is to be found in ordinary citizens of the land. And this, of course, I'm tying this all in now with the Nuremberg principles, what happened after World War II, when indeed it was determined in courts of law that ordinary citizens are responsible for the actions of their government. And there was a particularly important trial when we're talking to judges, trying to get judges to rule on this. There was a trial in 1949, 48 or 49, of the judges in Germany. There's a great movie, it's called Trial at Nuremberg or something, about this case. And the judges were found guilty of war crimes for not enforcing international norms, for allowing international crimes to take place even within their own country, for basically not getting involved in what their nation was clearly doing when the evidence was presented to them.
Mm-hmm.
So these are precedents that contradict or challenge this long-standing tradition. And these are some of the points that we're bringing up. And I feel it's also important to bring up to judges how our legal system does change. And we have made significant changes. And therefore, it is possible that even such a deep-seated tradition as this political question can be changed. It's not, yeah, that's what we're working on.
We have 4 minutes left. I'd like to open the phone lines if anyone has a question in these last 4 minutes. The number here is 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. John, is there anything that I haven't asked you or brought up that you'd like to tie into the subject?
Well, again, I guess I would just want to say that, you know, this is all about ending war, and it's not like this is a means to that end. And it's going to be crucial for our human future. And not only in and of itself ending war, but also establishing a norm of making and honoring agreements. And, of course, there's, you know, huge sort of cynicism in so many of us. It's saying, oh, you know, that's all too idealistic and, you know, it's completely impossible. But I would just say, you know, for the love of our children, we need to keep doing this. And to remind us that we have made significant changes in the past. So what seems impossible now can be done. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for everything you're doing.
I'll be talking to you again.
Okay.
Have a good morning.
Good morning to you.